Hi, I'm Anne Strainchamps, and today, things we tell boys.
Stop crying.
Stop with the tears.
Don't cry.
Pick yourself up.
Stop with the emotions.
Always keep your mind.
Nobody likes a tattletale.
Bros come before.
Don't let your woman run your life.
You bitch. Be a man.
Be a man.
Grow some balls.
So man up.
Man up.
Man up.
Man up.
Act like a man.
Be a man.
Be a man.
Today, on To the Best of Our Knowledge, masculinity in America and the male code. Be strong, be tough, don't cry. Boys get that message beginning around 5 or 6 years old. By high school, it's second nature, but it can also be toxic. Because boys in America today are not doing so well. Compared to girls, they're more likely to get diagnosed with a behavior disorder, drop out of school, binge drink, commit a violent crime, even kill themselves. So is that what it means to man up?
My uncle told me when I was 7 years old, you're the man of the house. You got to take care of your mother and your sister and your baby brother. Like, at seven, and I just want to go play. I don't want to go outside and play. Like, and he told me that. I was like, what does that mean?
This is Ashanti Branch. He's a high school teacher and mentor in Oakland, California. And when he first started teaching, he noticed that a lot of the boys at his school were kind of checked out. They weren't going to class, they weren't doing their work, and the majority of them weren't graduating. So Ashanti did something that seemed at first pretty simple. He started an after-school club for boys. And in that club, he pushed them to take off what he calls the male mask. The Ever Forward Club is now 10 years old. It's in a dozen or so schools in the Bay Area, and it's had a pretty astonishing success rate. More than 90% of the Ever Forward boys have gone on to college. Ashanti says in his experience, that's because the mask of masculinity handicaps boys.
You know, the mask is, it's a thing that we show the world. Like when we walk out to our homes to go and live our day, to work, to school, to play, to whatever things we do, like we, most people, they're clear that they have a mask that they show the world. And they're clear that they have a part of themselves that they don't talk about. Sometimes they don't talk about it ever. And so I think that with a lot of our young men, this idea, like, let me just show everybody that I'm happy, funny, cool, athletic, you know, intelligent, smart, hard, you know, whatever the characteristics that they show. And then there's that stuff sometimes that is just like, people couldn't handle this stuff. People couldn't handle knowing that I'm dealing with sadness or fear or depression. And also, in our society, there's not a lot of respect for a man who's afraid or who's sad. Mm-hmm. Or who's feeling like some kind of shame and guilt. Like, they're not looked up to, because most of the figures that our society highlights are those who are always powerful, dominating, controlling, and those kind of things. And so I think that some of our work is helping our young men have a safe place so that they can talk about the stuff that's really happening, all of it. So when they go out back to the world, they're not like built up all this pressure that's waiting to explode. And that's what I think sometimes happens with a lot of our young men.
So for you personally, I mean, what was the mask you grew up wearing and how did you adopt it? And at what point did you realize it was getting in your way?
Oh, man. Well, I think growing up, I'll say middle school was where there's like a lot of transformation was happening. You know, I knew that in my head, I thought I was kind of smart. But in middle school, it's not cool to be smart. And so my mask was like getting sliding by. Whatever, I don't care about this. No, I didn't do the homework because I didn't want to. And so I think it wasn't until this one teacher pulled me aside and really, you know, adjusted my thinking, you know, because I was dealing with a lot of sadness. You know, my father died before I was born. I was dealing with all this internal pain that I couldn't really talk about, because who do you cry out to about the fact that you're sad every time you see a father like picking up his son from school? Like, mm-hmm. When you see a father come to back to school night, like who do you talk to about that? Like, they were my friends. You couldn't talk to them about it. So I just had to hold it and I had to pretend like it didn't really exist.
What did this teacher say to you that changed?
Yeah. You know, she said, she had a speech, right? She was talking for about a long time. I don't remember much of it. I do remember one sentence. So, I was like staring at the corner. I'm not going to look at her, right? Cause if she's lecturing me, I'm just not gonna ignore her. But she said, I know you're sad. And that's the only reason I started listening. Because she was like, what, you can't call me sad. I'm a I'm a black boy from Oakland. Like, the one thing I cannot be is seen as sad. So I look, because I'm about to rebuttal her statement, and she's like, I know you're sad that your father died before you were born. And I was like, whoa, now you're talking my business. What's going on here? So I'm looking at her in her eyes. I'm like, how dare you, right? Because now I'm ready to, like, go in rage. Like, I'm getting angry. I am sad, but I don't want people to know it. And she's like, you know, but life doesn't give you what you want. Life gives you what you get. And you got to make the most out of it. And that sentence, like, is what I remember changing my life. You know, so you're too smart to be acting like you're not. And I don't know if it was the next day or a few days later, but I remember teachers coming up to me saying, what's going on with you? Like, you're doing work. Like, you're paying attention. Like, you're showing, like, I'm like, it never was that I couldn't do the work. I didn't care.
You know, that thing the teacher said to you, she named a feeling and kind of called it out for you, a feeling you didn't want to address. You said, the one thing a black boy from Oakland cannot be is sad. Like, why?
Yeah, because it's vulnerable. It's dangerous. Like, if you're walking around sad as a young man, you're seen as weak. And if you're seen as weak, you're seen as opportunity for prey. So my mode was just automatic. It wasn't even like I had planned to be like, I don't want her saying I'm sad. As soon as she said it, I was, like, clued into her words because I needed to, like, clear it up. I needed to, like, no, I'm not sad. I'm mad, right? Because mad is okay. Hmm. Like, I tell young men sometimes, you know, you got three emotions that are okay, acceptable. You got anger, you got funny, and then you got I don't care. Those are the ones that kind of, like, are okay and kind of tolerated. But when you start delving into the other emotions, I think most of our young men, our young men know that there's certain things that you have to just kind of keep tucked away. And so that's what, when we talked to them about taking off the mask, we're like, well, look, until society is ready for us as men to be everything we are, that means be able to show every emotion that we that possess, until they're ready, we're going to create a safe space for you to do it here. Because I believe, and what we do in Ever Forward, we believe that pressure of building up, of trying to pretend that you don't feel, is why our prisons are filled with 90% men, 93% men. Like, statistically, you would think that just men are bad. But I think it's something else. I think there's a lot more to it, is that men don't usually have a safe space of navigating those human emotions that would allow you to release them.
I was watching this documentary that showed you working with some young men, and they were all kind of sitting in a circle. And I think you gave them each a drawing of a mask. So can you describe the exercise and then tell us what happened after you did the exercise? How do the boys respond? What changes?
Well, you know, when they were coming to film, I told them that this circle I meet with, they're really great at young men, but they don't always are not really honest about how they're doing. So the mask activity, which is part of the Taking Off the Mask workshop, has evolved a lot since the documentary. But they had this mask and they wrote on the outside, what are the things they let people see? What are those things that they let people see about them? And then I asked them to turn it over and think about the things they don't let people see. And then when they had a chance to, like, exchange them around, you see in the documentary, they were throwing them at each other. But when they opened up one, they ended up with somebody else's. And when they read off the front, oh, I show the world that I'm happy, I'm funny, maybe someone on the front said, I show the world that I'm angry. But then on the back, most of them were just like fear, sadness. That was the first time they had opened up. So I was sitting there, you know, the cameras are there. I'm like, oh, man, like, I was hoping it worked, but I didn't know because I never got them to open up. Like, they were always saying, like, they were good. Oh, I'm good. Everything's good. I scale from 1 to 10. I'm a 10. I'm like, but they're not.
Did anything change after that? Like, the next time they came in, did they just cover it all up again? Or did you see conversations happen as a result that you wouldn't have seen before?
Oh, no. There was a lot of transformation in that space. Those who were at the taping that day, they had begun to build a deeper community. The ones who didn't show up, they're like, what happened? What's going on? And they're like, dude, you missed it. You know, you missed it. You, right? And so our meetings began to get a little deeper. And a lot of those young men, you know, went on to, you know, at least do some incredible things.
So paint me a picture of what it's like for a young man to get out of those boxes. Tell me about one young man who you've mentored, who's been in your program, and what changed for him as a result of being able to say and talk about being sad or feeling grief or whatever, and have other guys around him be able to hear it and say it's okay?
Yeah, there's so many stories. I think I'll speak to one which is really near and dear to my heart. So Lorenzo, who now is, has come full circle. He now is a mentor forever forward. He is one of our first employees. He's a program officer for us. When I first met him, he was funny, seriously funny, very charismatic, but not doing so hot in school, not deeply connecting to who he was and what the potential he had in him. And really, when he came to Ever Forward, he says when he first came, he came because there was free food, right? He came because there was free lunch. And, you know, he was living on couches from people. He was, like, homeless for a lot of times, living in different family members. And some of the things I didn't know because he never told me till later. I think it was for him to come to that place. And finally, when we went on our first college trip, we were at the beach. And the students went out and did their reflection. And they do a little quiet time. And I went over to him, and he was just, you know, there in the sand. I don't think he'd ever been to the beach before. And he was just crying, you know. And I said, what's going on? He's like all this time in my life, he didn't realize that there was a place where he could just be accepted for who he was and be around other students who were really just pushing him to be better. It's just been a pleasure watching him grow and watching him get on track and then go off to college, then be coming back to be a mentor for Ever Forward, and then now working for us. I think, and there's more stories. There's so many stories of young men who have finally awakened themselves to the fact that they're human. Man, it's just amazing to watch it happen.
Ashanti Branch is the founder and executive director of the Ever Forward Club in Oakland, California. It works with at-risk teenage boys. More than 90% of the kids who've taken part in that club have gone on to college. Ashanti is also featured in the recent documentary, The Mask You Live In. You can check that out on our website at ttbook.org.
Women gesture more when they speak. They call this a limp wrist. When I was younger, I used to gesture a lot, so I learned to keep my hands in my pockets. Women cross their legs when they sit, men keep their legs open. Women hold books across their chests, men hold them at their sides. Women listen to pop music, men listen to rock. Women sing to the radio, men nod along.
This is a clip from a short film called American Male. It's by Michael Rohrbaugh, and it won MTV's 2016 Look Different Creator Competition. So this film is just 6 minutes long, but it packs a punch. It's set in a frat house, which is pretty much everything you would imagine. Beer pong, drunk girls, guys with their shirts off, doing multiple shots, hazing rituals, fights. The twist is that the guy at the center of the film is clearly attracted to one of his frat brothers, and he has no idea what to do with that. Charles Monroe Kane sat down with Mark Rohrbaugh to discuss American Male.
What did it mean to be a man in your hometown?
Let's see. Growing up, I knew certain guys that would rather walk for a mile in the blazing hot sun than share a motorcycle seat with another guy or be seen doing so. Likewise, I know guys who would rather, like, burn to a crisp than ask another guy to rub sunscreen on their back. So there were all of these different codes and all of these kind of different things that one was supposed to or not supposed to do as being a man growing up in the middle of the Midwest.
You got out of that small town, right? You moved and you went to Yale. And then you were on the swim team at Yale. Did things get better for what it meant to be a man for you?
Not necessarily. Not at first. The swim team was a lot like a fraternity, as a lot of sports are, particularly team sports. So a lot of sort of gender norms were pretty strictly enforced on the swim team. I think because the guys were running around in tiny little Speedos, they had something especially extra to prove.
And it's probably something especially extra to be afraid of, right?
Definitely. Definitely. So you saw a lot of self-policing that was going on. And there was a lot of bravado that I think you find in American sports in general. For me, that was one of the reasons I ended up shying away from team sports in high school. Not because I didn't love the competition, but I didn't love the emphasis on these masculine norms. And I didn't kind of enjoy putting up a front about the person that I was supposed to be.
You're out. You're a gay man. But were you, did you know you were gay then? Or you just weren't out? Or did you not even know? I mean, what was going on in high school and college for you?
Yeah, I mean, it was a slow dawning realization. I would say that I've always known. And by the same token, it was something that kind of gradually came bubbling up from my subconscious. So, yeah, it was sort of a slow dawning discovery of who I was. I always knew that I was a bit different than a lot of other guys. I mean, I knew that there was a certain attraction there to other men. Yeah, that was kind of something that I struggled with a lot growing up.
And I think it's important to remind people here, you know, like in a hypothetical situation, right? You're at Yale, you're a freshman, you're at a frat party, you've been drinking, maybe drinking a lot. There's a bro hug. The bro hug goes 1 second too long. And, like, there could be violence in that situation.
Definitely. I mean, to some extent, for sure. Straying from these cultural gender norms is, in a way, like, tantamount to treason if you're in a certain type of setting. You know, it's interesting that you mention touch, like that you mention a hug, because I feel like toxic masculinity also deprives men of intimacy with their peers, which is why you see so many grown men, to be honest, without any close friends. It deprives men of that sort of non-sexual touch with other men, the kind of touch that brings us comfort and helps engender trust. So, which is, of course, part of the reason that so many men are actually drawn to sports. Beyond the thrill of competition, many sports teams also provide men with that rare outlet to emotionally connect with other men, to hug each other after they win a game or their team wins, to cry after a big game and profess their love for each other, and, you know, even to slap each other's asses.
Right.
In American society, like, the sports field is one of the few spaces where these types of actions are permitted and even celebrated, which ironically is precisely why these spaces remain so fiercely homophobic. Because whether they know it or not, men who don't openly identify as gay treasure the football field and the sports bar as a safe space where their masculinity and their sexuality will never be called into question, which means that they can engage in male intimacy without fearing that others will label them as gay. Alcohol provides that same excuse. It's part of the reason we see, you know, so many frat boys binge drinking, because it's the one excuse that they have to hug, you know, their friend and tell them how much they love them. Yeah, but if that hug lasts a little too long, or if it means something more than, you know, what we've culturally deemed it should mean, then you enter the danger zone.
If you could go in a time machine and go back to yourself in high school, you're not out, you know you're gay, and you could talk to yourself then, what advice would you give yourself?
I think I would tell myself that how many beers you can drink does not make a man. You know, don't try to measure your manhood by these standards that other people have set. Find a measurement that works for you. There's nothing wrong with the feminine. There's nothing wrong with the masculine. What's wrong is when we just get stuck in one mode. And when those boundaries and those lines become restrictive and oppressive. And I would just tell myself, don't take it all too seriously. Hmm. You know?
Yeah.
The whole point is to be free. So strive for that. You know?
You know, you're making a film now about masculinity in sports and LGBT issues in sports, and you're traveling around the country, you're meeting young people. There must be times where an out gay kid in Kentucky or Southern Alabama, after you film with them, must set you aside and like ask you for advice. I would ask you for some advice. You know, like what do you say to these young men when they're dealing with being gay in their small towns? Like, what advice do you give them? You're on the other side in their eyes.
I tell them to get out of Kentucky. That's what I say. I say you have to remove yourself from a situation that is not making you feel good about who you are. Some of them have very toxic relationships with their parents, and their parents are aware that they are gay and they do not accept them, and they shame them and they try to change them. And I say, as quickly as possible, remove yourself from that situation, because you need to become extremely confident in who you are. And the only way that you can do that at such a young age is to just be around people who are going to lift you up, you know, rather than tear you down.
In order to survive, a chameleon will change color to blend in with its surroundings. At a young age, I began to closely observe the people around me, the way they talked, the way they walked, what they said, where it got them. Now, I am no longer a person, but a set of social cues. Not a person, but a path of least resistance.
Michael Rohrbaugh is the director of the short film American Male. That won MTV's 2016 Look Different Creator competition. Charles Monroe Kane talked with him. And by the way, the entire film is available to watch on our website at ttbook.org. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. I learned a lot of things from raising my son. How to get a fish hook out of a hand. How to reply to a series of escalating yo mama jokes. Leave the room. What to say when an elementary school teacher tells your son, girls rule, boys drool. That one, I think, involved a few expletives of my own. And one other thing I learned from raising my son is that I really hate that phrase, man up. Hip-hop artist and poet Kyle Guante Tron Meyer has his own set of responses to being told to man up. 10, to be exact.
10 responses to the phrase, man up. 1, f*** you. 2, If you want to question my masculinity like a schoolyard circle of curses, like a sword fight with lightsaber erections, save your breath, because contrary to what you may believe, not every problem can be solved by growing a pair. You can't arm wrestle your way out of depression. The CEO of the company that just laid you off does not care how much you bench, and I promise there is no light beer in the universe full-bodied enough to make you love yourself. 3. Man up? That's that new superhero, right? Like mild-mannered supplement salesman Mark Manstrong says the magic words, man up, and then transforms into the 5 o'clock shadow, the massively muscled, deep-voiced, leather-duster-wearing Superman who defends the world from, I don't know, feelings. 4. Of course. Why fight to remove our chains when we can simply compare their lengths? Why step outside the box when the box has these badass flame decals on it? We men are cigarettes. Dangerous. And poisonous. 5. You ever notice how nobody ever says woman up? They imply it, but you generally don't hear it, like, stated explicitly. Because women and the women's movement figured out a long time ago that being directly, explicitly ordered around by commercials, magazines, music, and media is dehumanizing. When will men figure that out? 5. The phrase man up suggests that competence and perseverance are uniquely masculine traits. 6. The phrase man up suggests that competence and perseverance, both good things, are also uniquely masculine traits. That women, not to mention any man or anyone else who doesn't eat steak or drive a big truck or have lots of sex with women, are nothing. More than anything, though, it suggests that to be yourself, whether you wear skinny jeans or rock a little eyeliner or drink some other brand of light beer or write poetry, will cost you. 7. How many boys have to kill themselves before this country acknowledges that problem? How many women have to be assaulted? How many trans people have to be murdered? We teach boys how to wear the skin of a man, but we also teach them how to raise that skin like a flag and draw blood for it. 8. Boy babies get blue socks, right? Girl babies get pink socks. What about purple? What about green? What about orange? Cerulean, black, tie-dyed, buffalo plaid, rainbow, 9. I want to be free to express myself, man up. I want to have meaningful emotional relationships with my brothers, man up. I want to be weak sometimes, man up. I want to be strong in a way that isn't about physical power or dominance, man up. I want to talk to my sons about something other than sports, man up. I want to be who I am, man up. 10. No. Part of this poem isn't just saying let's redefine masculinity or let's talk differently about what it means to be a man. It's really like challenging the whole notion. There is only one way to be a man. You know, like even if that one way is something good or something that I support, I still think that it can be dangerous to talk about masculinity in that type of way in terms of like there's only one pathway forward. And whether that pathway is a good way or a bad way, I think the idea of a pathway in general can be tough. A lot of the work that I do is about thinking critically about identity in a general sense. So not just specifically about like gender stuff or gender identity, but also talking about race and class and religion and ability and sexual orientation, all the other kind of things that make us who we are, even when we don't want to talk about them or don't want to acknowledge that they exist. Like we all hold all these different identities inside of us, right? And so I think the conversation about, you know, what does it mean to be a man or what does it mean to be a good man? I don't think we can separate that conversation from all these other conversations about race and class and religion and sexual orientation, etc., right? It can be really helpful, not as a burden. I think it can be a tool to think about doing good in the world and doing good work in the world and being a fully realized, self-actualized person. I think it can be helpful to think about that this in a broader sense, where it isn't just about what makes you a good man. Like, I want to think about what makes you a good person. Which doesn't say that gender doesn't matter, that gender isn't part of that. But it is to say that I think we don't need to look at goodness through that lens, necessarily. So my work takes me all around the country. I go to colleges and high schools and conferences and stuff. And I talk to a lot of men, especially young men. And I think what I find more than anything is that there's very little pushback to the stuff that I talk about.
if anything, more young men are really, really hungry for these conversations. And so it's really, really cool to see how open a lot of young men are to these conversations. And it's just a matter of, like, how do we then have these conversations and push them and, you know, bring them up in spaces that we're in.
Kyle Guante Tronmeyer. He's a hip-hop artist and a two-time National Poetry Slam champion. His latest book of poetry is called A Love Song, A Death Rattle, A Battle Cry. And if you like the poem that he read here, you should see him perform it. Go to our website at ttbook.org. So this hour we're talking about masculinity in America, and there's a history to this conversation. Back in the 1970s, era of Ms. Magazine, Gloria Steinem, Betty Friedan, there was a smaller, less publicized men's liberation movement. And then in the late 70s, that movement split into two camps, a pro-feminist faction and the anti-feminist men's rights movement, which sees men as an oppressed group. Now, critics have accused them of creating a breeding ground for misogyny, internet trolling, and violence against women. The father of the men's rights movement is Warren Farrell. He's the author of the core text of the movement, The Myth of Male Power. Steve Paulson sat down with him for a candid talk about men's rights and masculinity in America today.
Do you think boys now are confused about what they're supposed to be, what it means to be a man?
Absolutely. In the old days, being a man was, in a sense, a disaster. Every society that survived based on its ability to train its sons to be disposable. So boys trained to be heroes by being disposable in war. They might train to be disposable in the workplace and oil rigs and coal mines and construction sites and so on. But because they were earning money, they at least felt they had a sense of purpose. So the good news that's happened is that we have fewer boys going to war, especially as a mandate. We have a smaller percentage of people dying in the workplace. But boys often feel that they don't have, what should they do? There's been a purpose void, but they're sort of looking around and saying, well, do I want to be like my dad? That's the primary sort of role model. And oftentimes their dad does not look happy, is not happy.
Why would this be any more confusing for boys than for girls now? I mean, do you think girls have an easier time of sort of finding their way and sort of knowing what to shoot for than boys do?
The blessing that the women's movement gave to girls and women was basically saying to girls, let's say there's you're married and you're both man and woman have a job and relatively decent job, and the woman becomes pregnant. The woman says basically to herself, I have three options here. Option one is to be full-time involved with my children. Option two is to be full-time involved with my workplace. Option three is to do some combination of both. The man just sort of sits back and he says, oh yeah, I have three options too. Option one is work full-time. Option two is work full-time. Option three is work full-time. And then if he earns a great deal of money, he calls it power. But power, if you feel obligated to earn money that often somebody else spends while you die sooner, I think that's a very deficient definition of power. But boys have bought into that such a fundamental level, and there's been no men's movement to help boys question that paradigm.
Whether this is the kind of power they would really want. Because, I mean, the irony, of course, is that, you know, in most positions of power in our society, men still dominate. You know, they make up the vast majority in Congress, of corporate boards, you know, all those kind of big, powerful places that we see in society. But you're saying maybe that's, you know, not necessarily something that most boys actually want to aspire to.
That's right. And they're looking at the people, they're looking at their own lives and saying, do I really want to be working 80 hours a week, 70 hours a week to spend my life subservient to somebody that as I climb the ladder to get to the top of a ladder that I really, that's leaning on a wall that I don't want to be on. And feeling obligated to do anything is not about power. Being told you will be a hero if you go to war and die for us is a social bribe to die.
So I want to bring in the men's rights movement here and sort of what this is a response to, because you are commonly called the father of the men's rights movement. What do you see as the goal here, as the value of this movement?
the men's rights movement in its sort of current form is like someone who is shouting to be heard for 30 years and has not been heard. And when people shout to be heard, they get hurt, they get mean, they distort, they do anything to get attention. And so many people in the men's rights movement are highly intelligent and thoughtful. Other people in the men's rights movement feel that women have gotten a lot of opportunities that men don't have, and that nobody sees the opportunities that men don't have. And because no one is listening and has given them credence, they are often shouting just to get the attention. So that, you know, the best thing we
we should point out, I mean, there is a nasty side to all of this. As one reporter has called it, you know, it's an army of misogynists and trolls on the internet in particular. So that, I mean, you're not discounting that. You're saying that is there.
Yes. Well, first of all, it isn't an army of, but many of the people in the men's movement are so hurt and in such pain that they're shouting out. And when people don't get heard, as in any relationship, they start getting meaner and meaner and angrier and saying things that are in the extreme, because the first need of all people is to be heard. And so if we want to do the best we can is hear everyone, hear instead of saying trolls or army of, let's say, what are they trying to say that we aren't hearing? When the women's movement first surfaced, I remember, and I was on the board of NOW in New York City, as you know, I remember being on the Barbara Walters show, on the Today Show, and Barbara Walters said, well, how can you be part of a movement where you have people like Kate Millett, who is bisexual? This was a number of years ago when this was considered not okay, even by somebody progressive like Barbara Walters. And I said, Barbara, first of all, people who are bisexual may see the heterosexual world more clearly than we do. Why don't we open our ears to what the women's movement is saying? And instead of calling them dykes and bra burners, why don't we hear their best intent? Why don't we hear what is not being articulated? And that led me to spending a good part of my life supporting the women's movement and trying to articulate to men who were feeling threatened by it what the women's movement's best intent was.
And we should just reiterate this point, because, I mean, this is kind of fascinating. I mean, you, who are so identified with the men's rights movement, I mean, back in the 70s, you worked for the National Organization for Women. You were on NOW's New York City chapter board. You were called the Gloria Steinem of men's liberation. I think that's going to surprise a lot of people.
And really, the myth of male power was really inspired in many respects by Betty Friedan's second book, a second major book called The Second Stage, in which she said that we've done a great job with women, and now we have to focus on men. And if we don't focus on men, the second stage of the women's movement, we will be in trouble. And I started researching the myth of male power and saw, yes, men are already in trouble, and we have to start listening. But there's an underlying reason that we don't listen to men, and that is because part of what toxic masculinity is about is men, in order to become successful, have to learn to repress their feelings, not express their feelings. So when a man is feeling down and depressed, we don't hear about it, but he may act out instead, like drinking, driving, or getting DUIs. And so the parents focus on the DUIs, and that we don't focus on the hurt and the pain that is leading to the DUIs, the questions that aren't being asked. And we have things, for example, like, you know, we have, I think it's 6 offices, federal offices of women's health. We have no offices of men's health, even though men die sooner. If we consider ourselves progressive and liberal, we need to see the pain of men as well as women, and boys as well as girls. And that's our next evolutionary mandate.
Where does the current political scene fit into all of this? Because some of these ideas are getting played out within the white nationalist movement, what's been called the alt-right, and a certain kind of hyper-masculinity has surfaced. I mean, clearly seems to be part of the appeal of this movement, and also would seem to relate to electing Donald Trump as president. What do you make of the ascendancy of this particular piece of our culture?
I think the ascendancy of sort of the Trump type of era is boys and men who have felt unheard and now feel that somebody who is speaking like they speak, but is not a loser like they're afraid of being if they opened up their mouth, because he is a billionaire. And so they can sort of say, okay, if a billionaire who's really successful is speaking like I'm speaking, maybe I have something to say and maybe I should be heard. And so I worked very, very hard with the top advisors of the Clinton campaign to ask them to open up an avenue for boys and men to be heard, to sort of say, to acknowledge that there is a boy crisis, to acknowledge that there is a crisis of fatherlessness, and to say how important it is to keep fathers in the family. That was not heard by Hillary Clinton, I'm afraid. And so she, in my opinion, left out an enormous population. I contributed significantly to her campaign, as my wife did. I'm a strong supporter of her. I like her. I thought she would not be a good president. I thought she'd be a great president. But yet, she left this enormous hole open that she was not willing to go into and to deal with. And so we got a boy in the White House. We got somebody who, you know, any mother who's training their son to be a emotionally intelligent boy is training their son to do things and be differently than the person who will be our next president. And that's deeply, deeply sad. But we have gotten what we have neglected.
What about the phrase man up, which we hear all the time? One of our guests in this hour considers it the most destructive phrase in the English language. What do you make of that phrase, man up?
I would agree with one of your guests. Man up is basically social pressure. There's two ways we get men to do what we want them to do. That does not serve the man, but serves the society. We have to always remember that what served the society does not serve the man. Every society survived based on its ability to train its sons to be disposable in war. Being in war served the protection of the society, but it created in men characteristics that were extremely unhealthy to men. One of the ways we did that was telling him, man up. So even today, as we speak, men are expected to register when they're 18 for the draft. Not expected to, they're required to. If they don't do so, they have $250,000 fine. They're put in prison for 5 years. After 5 years in prison, they cannot get any federal jobs, any state jobs. They cannot even, in many states, not even get their driver's license. Do men complain about it? No. Why? Because men have internalized learning to man up. If women were required to register for the draft with those types of penalties, if they didn't, and men were not, millions of women would speak out. They would make it politically unable to continue as a policy to be the only gender to register for the draft. So we've created an era of what I would call the multi-option woman and the no-option man.
But what about those men who clearly are misogynistic, you know, let's say at a men's rights conference or online and just saying nasty things about women? Do you feel it's your responsibility as one of the intellectual leaders of this movement? Do you feel like other leaders have a responsibility to speak out and say, hey, this is wrong, stop it?
Yeah, my first response to all misogyny or misandry, like the Scum Manifesto that we talked about before, my first response to a Valerie Solanas when she's, you know, saying there should be a society for cutting up men, or for a man that is saying that, you know, don't ever get married, all women are, you know, just basically prostitutes or whatever they might say, my first response is to listen. When you hear somebody, they start their anger, especially if you say, you know, what I heard you say was this or what I heard you say was that, and it's an accurate reflection of what they're saying, then you begin to lower their temperature to what they're really feeling and how they're really hurting. So I want to get to the pain behind women in the women's movement who were filled with anger, that were always called anti-male, who were, you know, bra burners, that they would say, or just, you know, women who were really speaking negatively about men. And I want to get to the bottom of what the guys are feeling when they are speaking out so negatively and destructively about women, and therefore self-destructively, because any man who speaks like that is also being self-destructive as well. And then once I hear him, I want to be able to share some other perspectives that allow him to see something different once he is not in anger mode. I do go on shows for everyone who asks me, you know, where there's a group of people who will listen and hear, and I present what I feel are the real issues. And I hope that the real issues allow people to feel heard enough so that their anger is significantly reduced.
Well, thank you so much. This has been a pleasure to talk with you.
It's been a real pleasure to talk with you, too. I thank you for caring enough to ask and listening so well.
Warren Farrell is one of the founders of the men's rights movement and author of the 1993 book, The Myth of Male Power. Steve Paulson talked with him. We've covered a lot of perspectives on manhood in today's show, but there's one we're missing, yours. How do you think things have changed for men today? What's one important thing that you'd say all men need to know? Call and leave us a voicemail at 877-782-8942. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. This week, Houston Smith died at age 97. He was a great scholar of world religions. A lot of people remember him from the Bill Moyers PBS series, The Wisdom of Faith. But here are some other things to know about him. Houston Smith started out as a Methodist minister, but he became a world traveler and a student of many religions, Islam, Buddhism, Confucianism, Hinduism. He believed that the world's great faith traditions are a repository of deep human wisdom. He also looked for God outside organized religion, including in Timothy Leary's living room as part of the famous Harvard Psilocybin Project. So to say goodbye to him, here's an excerpt from Steve Paulson's 2002 conversation with the late Houston Smith.
I need to say what the heart of the religious worldview is. It is that there is more to reality than the physical universe. The scientific method came into being 16th, 17th century, is the near perfect way of discovering the physical nature, the physical and the laws and the processes. It has shown nature to be awesome beyond belief. But on the question if there is anything more than this physical universe, science cannot say one word about that. I like a metaphor that came to me. It's as if we human beings were inside a gigantic balloon and we have flashlights. And flashlights are metaphors for the scientific method. We can shine those flashlights on anything inside the balloon, but there's no way that we can get our flashlight outside the balloon. Now, it's on that point where all the great enduring religions speak with one voice, that there is a more beyond the physical universe.
You're talking about God here, or do you want to avoid that word?
I'm not excluding God, but I don't have to stay with that word. I think the inclusive word is transcendence, which has built into it something that transcends this world. And the Chronicle of Higher Education put it very succinctly about a decade ago when it said, if anything characterizes modernity, it is the loss of transcendence. And then it goes on to say what it means by transcendence. A reality that encompasses and surpasses our quotidian affairs, everyday affair.
Is it important for a person of faith to experience transcendence at some personal level?
It's all to the good, if one can. And actually, I think everybody does, but doesn't call it that or anything. I'm talking about those exceptional experiences. Abraham Maslow would have called them peak experiences, but they are those thin places between this world and a greater reality where the clouds of ignorance sort of seem to part for a moment and something comes through that, as Saul Bellow says, all you can say is it comes from somewhere else.
Have you had any experiences like this?
Oh, I feel like saying, darn you, you trap me. Yes, but though I'm a cognitive mystic, I, at the University of Chicago, was a scientific materialist to the core. And then when I came on books like Aldous Huxley, The Perennial Philosophy, and The Mystical Testament of What This Greater Reality Is, I found myself resonating from the soles of my feet all the way up, saying, yes, 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 that is the way it is. And I have never deviated from that as true cognitively. But experientially, I'm a very flat-footed mystic. I've had some ordinary garden variety mystical experience, but I do not have the talent of the natural-born mystic for really experiencing that vividly and pretty constantly.
World religion scholar Houston Smith. In a 2002 interview with Steve Paulson, Smith died last week at his home. He was 97 years old. And that's it for this episode. Thanks for listening, and I hope you come back for more. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Charles Monroe Kane put this episode together. He had help from Raymond Tungekar, Doug Gordon, and Mark Rickers. Our theme music is by Steve Mullen from WalkWest Music. The technical director for To the Best of Our Knowledge is Joe Hartke. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. I'm Ann Strainchamps, and I'm glad you were with us today.
PRI, Public Radio International.